From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Bor Dieng, correspondent for the Times of London, Joshua Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Turkey attacks Kurdish forces in Syria after the United States moves its troops out of the way. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump picks up steam. We'll have the latest on trade talks between the United States and China. And speaking of China, a dust-up between Beijing's communist government and the NBA, that, of course, the National Basketball Association. Well, let's start with Turkey, which has attacked Kurdish forces in Syria. Now, those Kurdish troops have served for many years as the principal American ally in Washington's battle against the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL. The attack came after a phone call between Turkish President Erdogan and President Trump. Now, Josh Glancy of the Sunday Times, this is all rather complicated, a lot of moving parts here, but to boil this down for our global listeners, if you could.
Well, after this phone call between Trump and Erdogan, which really no one else knew about, I mean, one of the key points to recognize here is this isn't going through the ordinary foreign policy process. Trump ordered the withdrawal of American troops from two bases in Syria, although he says he didn't green light the Turkish invasion. Explicitly, implicitly, he did. And the Turks are piling into northern Syria in force. And different reports have come out, but they're telling us that hundreds of what they call Kurdish terrorists, but we would not see them that way necessarily, but have been killed. And they're making serious incursions in northern Syria. So it upends what was a pretty fragile situation, a pretty delicate situation, is now in total chaos at the moment.
Let's provide a little bit of a context here, and then I'll go to you, Bor. You know, when the U.S. was fighting the Islamic State, our Kurdish allies liberated large chunks of territory, millions of people freed from being under the shadow of this terror group. And there's a retired U.S. Army general, a four-star general, Joseph Vlodel, who led U.S. Central Command during this campaign against ISIS. And he said, look, the Kurds did the heavy lifting here. They suffered something like 11,000 casualties here. We could not have done it without them. He's bitter that President Trump has apparently, he didn't green light it explicitly, as Josh said, but moved our troops out of the way. That is what one of our top American generals says.
Yeah, and that criticism isn't just coming from the top of the military chain of command, but coming universally from pretty much every corner of American politics as well as military life. There have been reports of an unnamed soldier who's stationed there who said, this is the first time that I've been ashamed of being a part of the U.S. military because we've abandoned our allies in a completely unprecedented and shocking way. There's confusion on the ground as to why the U.S. is abandoning its longstanding ally and allowing this incursion to happen. And there's a lot of domestic criticism as well, even from some of the people who have been President Trump's staunchest allies, people like Lindsey Graham, who's a Republican senator, who's very sort of hawkish, a senator who's backed Trump, and people.
The exact quote, in fact, Graham said that accuses President Trump, as you say, one of his strongest supporters, of, quote, shamelessly abandoning a loyal American ally. That's one of President Trump's best supporters.
Exactly. And people who have been unwilling to criticize the president on a number of other domestic issues that have been very controversial have come out unitedly to say, look, this is wrong, this is shocking, and it will have huge repercussions for not only American national security, but international security as well, because having one of America's staunchest allies who helped us with the defeat of the Islamic State is going to trigger a possibly a refugee crisis as lots of people flee northern Syria. And it could possibly trigger the reemergence of ISIS as Kurdish fighters are sort of abandoning their previous posts or have no reason to sort of stay with their previous posts as they have to go and defend against the Turkish offensive. And there's real fear that hostages, ISIS hostages that are being held in northern Syria might be able to now sort of seize the moment to find new momentum for their movement. So it's got huge implications internationally.
Well, Josh, as we mentioned up top, a lot of moving parts here, and Bohr mentioned a couple of them. One thing in particular is that some of the analysts who've been looking at this have said, interestingly enough, President Trump has tried to tighten the screws on Iran ever since coming into office. And yet some say, well, this is actually a plus to Iran, what he has done. What is your view?
Well, I think it's, first of all, worth adding a couple of caveats to what's happening in Syria. One is that there was already a refugee crisis. It's not like there was a good situation. There are millions of Syrian refugees in Turkey. It's not a particularly sustainable situation. That's not to say it's getting better. It's probably getting worse. But it's not like it was a sort of a very happy situation. This is also not in any way the first time that America has screwed over the Kurds. In fact, you can go back to the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923, and the Kurds, partly because they've never had sovereign territory, have been screwed over many, many times. And they were also fighting in their own interest against ISIS. This wasn't an altruistic act that they were taking. You know, that ISIS is their enemy too. Nonetheless, it does shift the balance of power in the region, potentially. The Iranians, obviously, back in the Assad regime, which is effectively their client, will potentially be strengthened by this. Although it sort of depends how far Turkey go into Syria. And there are concerns in Damascus about the extent of Turkey's incursion. So I think everyone's monitoring very closely how far they go. But the other interest in the Middle East that's very concerned at the moment is Israel, who also have a very strong stake in maintaining a balance of power and keeping the Iranians at bay. And they've already, you know, they've got Iranian interests in Gaza, in Lebanon. And so they're very, very cautious about Syria, which is also on their border. So, yeah, it's definitely a combustible situation. But at the moment, the Turks are staying within what appear to have been some vaguely agreed parameters, which are in terms of the extent of their incursion, in terms of not, we're not seeing any ethnic cleansing yet, but we're only a few days into this.
Yeah, and there's already been quite a lot of, you know, bombings and, as Paul, you mentioned earlier, sort of casualties, civilians on the ground. And Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, was among the first to also condemn the U.S. withdrawal, to say Israel will provide humanitarian assistance, whatever that means. He tweeted it the other day. So, you know, like Josh was saying, there's a great potential for a realignment of the balance of power, a potential for our Kurdish allies to say, well, look, you know, maybe it's time for us to cozy up to the Assad regime or to the Russians, given that the American forces have backed away. So it's an extremely volatile situation. Besides the security implication, as Josh was sort of alluding to, also has implications for how the diplomatic and sort of political balance in the region will play out.
Now, taking a step back from sort of the on-the-ground situation here, kind of a broader issue that people have been talking about this week is sort of long-term American credibility in terms of backing away from an ally. Now, President Trump has said, look, we can't keep fighting all these wars around the world. That's another debate, and it's an interesting and worthy question to ask. But nevertheless, here is something that I'll read this to you. Brett McGurk, who is the president's former envoy to the Global Coalition to Fight ISIS, and he tweeted earlier this week, and I'll quote here, he says, "The value of an American handshake is depreciating. Trump says we could crush ISIS again if it regenerated." And then he says, "But who would fight with us? What allies would sign up? Who would fight on President Trump's assurances now?" And again, so the president's credibility, Josh, is being questioned by people who used to work for him.
Yeah, I mean, it should be noted that he inherited Brett McGurk, and the two never liked each other very much. But yes, you're right. I mean, and it's not just the president's credibility, it's America's. I was with H.R. McMaster yesterday, who's a former national security advisor, who spoke very eloquently on what he called the defeatism of American policy, the sense that foreign policy, the sense that nothing really can be done. And maybe it's an overcorrection from the Iraq war days when there was perhaps too much swagger and there was a sense that too much could be done. But you're right, there is a sense that if America is a purely transactional player, it's not going to be the world's policeman, certainly under President Trump, then people will look to other allies. You saw this with the Saudis after the attack on the Aramco oil plant by Iran, and the Americans have effectively done nothing about that, even though it was a pretty clear red line that was crossed by the Iranians. And the Saudis, well, they're looking to China, aren't they? Because they need someone to underwrite their security in the region. And if the Americans aren't going to do it, then they'll find someone that can. So there is a danger that America is simply being too isolationist and allowing these things to fester in parts of the world, that it will ultimately affect America. As you say, you know, if ISIS comes back, then their central ideology, it remains the destruction of America, the destruction of everything that America stands for. So it's not like you can just wash your hands with it and say, well, you know, we'll find a different way to defeat them. You know, you need to keep working on these issues. And that's why actually having a relatively small force in Syria that wasn't really in any particular danger, it's not like there were body bags coming home to Andrews every week, was probably a pretty good trade for the level of sort of security and stability it was providing in the region. So this wasn't like Iraq, Afghanistan. There wasn't a massive, you know, thousands of boots on the ground situation. It was probably a pretty good situation as these things go in Syria. So it does feel probably short-sighted to upend it.
But I think one of the points that you brought up, Paul, that was really good, is that sometimes I think allies around the world don't realize how much American foreign policy, especially under this president, is sort of being dictated by domestic ones. Because one of the points that Trump made was that, look, I campaigned on this. I campaigned on getting America out of the world and stopping these endless wars. And I have to sort of make good on that promise. But people who are perhaps more longer-sighted, as Josh and Paul that you talked about, are saying, look, if we don't fulfill our commitments, what's to say that, you know, South Koreans will trust us next time we say that we'll defend their security in the Pacific, or
the former Soviet republics, Baltics,
exactly,
which are now NATO
allies. Yeah. Exactly. And I think Marco Rubio, who's, you know, another Republican who's supported Trump in the past, has said damage to our reputation will be long-lasting.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Bo Dieng, correspondent for the Times of London, Joshua Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and moderator Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. Here in Washington, the impeachment inquiry into President Trump is accelerating now. As we've mentioned before, this impeachment process is rather complicated. The House of Representatives, which is our lower chamber of the legislature, is conducting an investigation. At some point, it may take a vote on so-called articles of impeachment. And then if it votes to impeach the president, that's only the end of the first step. It would then go to the Senate, the upper chamber of our legislature, which would then vote on whether to actually convict, in other words, remove the president from office. With that background, and I'll start with Bo, the Democrats in the past couple of days have really turned up the heat here, issuing subpoenas on leading officials in the Trump White House, including they've requested documents from the Secretary of State, all kinds of people. There have been a couple of interesting arrests in the last couple of days as well. Bring us up to date on where we are with this.
Yeah, Paul, as you say, this scandal just seems to be getting bigger and bigger and doing so very rapidly. You're quite right. The House of Representatives, some members have stayed over the course of a planned recess for Congress. Instead of going back to their districts, have sort of stayed in Washington, issued these summons to all sorts of people who were named in a whistleblower complaint against the president, which alleged that he had tried to coerce or pressure the Ukrainian president into helping him find political dirt on a rival, Joe Biden.
Mr. Zelensky.
Yes, Mr. Zelensky is the Ukrainian president. So the House has been issuing these summonses to people from Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, to Rick Perry, the Energy Secretary, to various members of the State Department who were named in that complaint as having either knowledge of or being involved in these setting up various meetings and helping the president's personal lawyer go and do this quote-unquote investigation on his potential rival, Mr. Biden. And the latest sort of quite a scandalous development that happened this week was that there were two Soviet-born businessmen, based in Florida, who had been donors to pro-Trump campaign groups, who had worked with the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to help set up various meetings with Ukrainians. And they were arrested on Wednesday evening trying to leave the U.S. with one-way tickets to Europe. And they were arrested and charged with finance violations. Basically, they've been accused of setting up a front company that funneled money from overseas, probably Russia, to donate into these campaign groups that were pro-Trump. They were also accused of trying to solicit lobbying to try to get the Trump administration to fire a former Ukrainian ambassador, which subsequently happened. And they're, of course, involved in these sort of slightly sketchy meetings. So it's a very big spiraling scandal with the latest.
So a whole bunch of stuff. And then, Josh, all of these things swirling about over the president. And yet, if you talk to him, he continues to say that, look, I've done nothing wrong here. The real issue is over there with the Bidens, and this is just presidential harassment. Others say, look, where there's smoke, there's fire. You've been watching this for quite some time. What do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty clear there's fire. You know, we have the transcript. We know that even if there was no, as they say, quid pro quo in terms of asking the Ukrainians, specifically threatening them to withhold aid in return for investigating the Bidens.
It doesn't have to be as explicit as people think.
It doesn't. And we, even if you take the aid out, he's still, you know, pushing a foreign country to investigate his political rival, which is very problematic.
And he's asked others, too.
He has. And he openly asked China on the White House lawn last week to investigate the Bidens as well. But the thing about Trump, which you've alluded to slightly, is that he can walk on fire in the sense that this is a man who's had over 4,000 lawsuits in his life. Constant belligerence is his modus operandi. He is, in a funny way, I don't think he enjoys it, but he sort of needs this, you know, in a way. I mean, the amazing thing about this scandal is the day after the Mueller inquiry ended, you know, Mueller testified, and you think, gosh, that awful Damocles sword that was hanging over his presidency is over. The next day, the very next day, he's on the phone to Zelensky having this very odd conversation about asking him to investigate the Bidens. This is kind of Trump's nature. And if you watched him, he was at a rally in Minnesota. You know, he's going with it. He's fighting. He's not, he punches back hard. He was very rude, used very unpleasant language about the Bidens. And his base were loving it. The place was packed to the rafters. They were energized. They were angry. They were shouting, lock him up, about Hunter Biden. You know, they're ready to go.
Well, one thing about that, let me take a step back here. It's interesting, and this plays into this ongoing impeachment inquiry. You know, the House can, you can impeach a president for stepping on a crack on the sidewalk. I mean, the definition is high crimes and misdemeanors, and you can define that any way you want. And it's important to remember when people say, well, the Mueller report is history. Well, the Democrats say it's really not, because that report still mentioned 10 possible instances of obstruction of justice. And they haven't forgotten about that. So, yes, there was this no collusion between the Russians, but these 10 allegations of obstructing justice is not a small matter, and they're going to continue to bring that up. What else are they looking at as they pursue this inquiry against the president?
Yeah, I think the obstruction stuff that you mentioned, Paul, is very relevant, because Democrats have also alluded to looking at more obstruction, because amid this impeachment inquiry, the administration has been very uncooperative. They've been unwilling to present documents. Mike Pompeo has said, how dare you bully the State Department? We're not going to cooperate. And the Democrats have come back and said, well, we're just going to view that as more evidence that you're obstructing Congress, obstructing our ability to do what is our constitutional duty, which is to give oversight. What's remarkable, as Josh alluded to earlier, is that it's still quite a gamble, because the Trump base, his supporters will say, you know, this is just Mueller 2.0. Nothing came of that. This is just Democrats holding a grudge against the president that they've been trying to get out of office since day one. And it could actually, you know, be a bit of ammunition in Trump's hands, which he is using.
Well, that's possible, though. But then when you look at some of these surveys, even from Fox News, which people around the world might not know, Fox News is this conservative television channel here. It's the president's apparently principal sources of information. And they released a poll, you know, on Fox saying that 51% of registered voters support this impeachment inquiry. So, and there have been other polls showing that a month ago, obviously, no Republicans supported an inquiry. Now it went from 12 to 17. And there was a survey the other day saying that now 30% of Republicans support an inquiry. So the numbers appear to be kind of moving against the president here. Is that how you see it?
Moving a little bit. I'd be pretty skeptical of drawing conclusions are too significant from those numbers. I mean, they can be very soft. The fact is this president has always been unpopular, and so it's not surprising that half the country wants to see him out of office. That's kind of always been true. But what we can't forget is what Bohr said, which is that a large chunk of the country also loves the guy and will only love him more as he continues to be attacked and will perceive these attacks as really just another attempt to oust him from office, or coup, as he would call it. And so you have this polarization, and frankly, the Republican senators who ultimately hold the president's fate in their hands, as you mentioned earlier, they would be the ones to convict him and actually oust him from office if it got that far. They're going to respond to their base much more than they're going to respond to the 50% of the country that probably isn't going to vote for them anyway. There is perhaps some danger about moderates and independents, and they'll be watching that, but ultimately, none of these people can get elected without Trump's supporters. And he knows that, and they know that. And so at this point, I don't see a massive crack appearing. But, you know, there's more to come. We're going to find out more. This is a fast-moving story.
Got just about 3 minutes left here, and I did want to talk very quickly about the latest on these U.S.-China trade talks, which have resumed now very quickly. Trump's been saying for a couple of years now that these talks are going well, trade wars are easy to win, all evidence to the contrary. What's going to happen now very quickly?
So today, Trump is meeting one of the Chinese vice premiers in the White House, Liu He. Markets were up because there is some promise of a mini deal, even if it's not going to be the comprehensive deal that Trump has been promising for ages. There's some optimism that there might be some deals being struck on currency and agreements on intellectual property. But Paul, as you say, he's been promising a great, wonderful deal for ages. He really needs at least a little bit of a win. That may happen. There's optimism. However, it's a question of how far that will actually get him. And it might be the spike in the markets might be sort of quite temporary, as we've seen in the past.
And speaking of China, there's a dust-up, quite interesting, between the National Basketball Association, the NBA, and China, and it concerns these anti-government protests which have been going on in Hong Kong for quite some time. One member of the Houston Rockets, one of the teams, tweeted support for the anti-government protesters, and that has sparked a rift between the communist government and the NBA. The commissioner of the NBA has refused to apologize for this. It's a free speech issue. Where is this going, John?
I think this is going to be one of the big issues of the next decade. I really do, because what you have now, you know, since China entered the world economy in 1992 and entered the WTO, businesses like the NBA or Disney have vast commercial interests in China. And so they now need to decide, well, do they adhere to American rules about free speech and everything we would expect about openness and an open society, or do they adhere to Chinese rules? At the moment, they're folding to China because they're too scared about their bottom line. But this is a big deal. I mean, you had a guy at the Washington Wizards this week hold up a sign in support of the Uyghurs, who are, you know, an appallingly treated minority in China. Many put in concentration camps and disappeared overnight. And the Wizards made the guy take the sign down. Now, that is, I hate the word un-American, but that is un-American. That is not something that we would expect to see at a basketball game in Washington, D.C. Now, this is a reckoning that's about, it's about American values, and are American corporations going to uphold those values, or do they care about their bottom line?
All right, we're going to have to end it right there. Unfortunately, our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Bo Ding, she's the correspondent for the Times of London, and Josh Glancy of the Sunday Times. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer, Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today. Thanks for joining us.